Earplay is made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. A series of contemporary plays for radio. Earplay. This week, Earplay presents The Temptation Game by the American writer John Gardner. Gardner is best known as the author of six novels, among them The Sunlight Dialogues, Nickel Mountain, and his latest, published in 1976, October Light. For several years, Gardner taught medieval literature at Southern Illinois University. He now lives, writes, and teaches in Bennington, Vermont. He was commissioned by Earplay to write a drama for radio, The Temptation Game, by John Gardner.
Devil of a night. No moon. No stars. Get the wolves off there. Howling as if the fiend was about. Listen to him, friend.
Wolves. Yes, I know. No harm in wolves.
It ain't natural. Wolves howling and not a shred of a moon. Portends no good. Troubled times for England. That's what it portends. Wind from the north, too. Never a good sign. You've heard about the births.
Births? I'm afraid
prodigious births, all the length and breadth of England, brother, so men say. Perhaps the news is slow to reach you, hidden away the way you are at the top of the world in your monastery, but believe me, brother, down here in the hustle and bustle below, there's mysteries afoot. God only knows what it signifies.
God can, when he pleases, make
one
things...
One thing sure, old Jack's got an eye on things.
Jack?
The devil, sir. Jack Horn. He's got hundreds of names, sir, and as many faces. He's not far away. Take a shrewd old traveler's word for it. Old Jack's no stranger these lonely parts. But nobody knows that better than you, huh? It's a monk's special business.
A monk, yes.
You monks develop a feeling for these things, huh? Up there on the mountaintop, far from men. I admire the monastic life, believe me. Seeking out devils in their own remote kingdom of high sheer cliffs, haunted lakes, dark forests, moving right in on them, challenging their ancient solitary reign.
As to that, cities too.
Your name's Brother John, I think you said.
Brother John, yes. Oh, I think so. I can't remember. Somehow I...
Now, easy, easy. Now, at ease. Don't do your wits. Now, we'll have your head clear as a bell pretty soon. You lean on me. That's the way. I may be as old as the back door to hell, but I ain't weak. No, sir. I've been roaming this wilderness more years than you'd believe. It's given me endurance. You lean on old Gristle, brother. Now, that's the way.
Oh, God bless you, old man. But who are you?
Now, don't talk. Save your strength. We'll be there pretty quick now. See that glimmer up ahead? That's the Black Oak Inn. They'll fix you up. Little food in your belly, little hot spiced wine to wet your whistle, sir.
Yes, food.
Innkeeper, open up, you got company.
Hush, your noise, you hellhound. Tain't natural. Whole countryside crawling with dogs, filling up the night with their confounded brattle. Chicken thieves, grave robbers, molesters of poor harmless traveling men. And worse things than dogs, too. How could you speak of it? Owls and muttering, chattering magpies in every country croft and haymow. Cats in the alleyways. Frogs in every ditch. Hello in there!
Patience, can't you? I'm coming as quick as an old man can.
Who the hell been knocking on a poor old gentleman's door at this hour? Not that you ain't welcome, says the spider to the fly. Oh, it's true. It's a little past me bedtime.
Now, don't fool with me, innkeeper. You know as well as I do, nobody sleeps a wink at the Black Oak Inn. Too much sin and unholy carouse. And yes, sir, you're a standing outrage and an offense to King Richard's peace.
Now, that's a lie, sir. The most damnable and ungenerous and unflattering lie. There's nobody here but honest men, so far as nature allows. As St. Paul himself says, we've all got our frailties and faults, so that some poor unfortunates have proclivity for wenches and some poor souls for fisticuffs. But, says St. Paul, better to be merry than to burn.
Hell save us from empty loquacity, I say. Now look down here, you old lard pot, and give a man a hand. My friend here, he's done too well.
Oh, look at him. White as me bum he is. Holy brother, take a man's arm.
Oh, I'm all right. Thank you. Perhaps a little dizzy.
It's a curious business, innkeeper. Says his name's Brother John from the monastery. I found him leaning against a tree down the road, standing there, glassy-eyed as King Edward's ghost.
Let's get you in.
What's this?
You're there, my lord. Kind of hold the door. It's Furley.
Yes, I live and breathe.
You know him, my lord.
Well, certainly, it's John Furley. I grew up with a man. Oh, he was hardly a monk in the days I knew him. John! John, look at me. It's your old friend Thomas, Tom of Ipswich.
Oh, forgive me, my mind. I'm afraid.
Impossible, he can't have forgotten me. Here, bring him to the lodgings I've taken him back. That is to say, the lodgings we've taken, my two friends and I. John knows us. We'll see to him. Poor creature. Acts like a man who's had a bump on the head, or perhaps seen some specially grim execution. That'll do it, you know. I've seen it many times, most notably in cases of drawing and quartering. Doesn't bother me, of course. I'm in the legal profession. Even the most spectacular of our executions, such as burnings or crushings, are everyday matters to a man like me. But sometimes to people of tender sensibility, nobly effeminate people, if you follow me, people with a saintly delicacy of stomach. Not that I don't admire such people, as I'm sure you understand. Though I watch with a touch of amusement, I confess, when grown men sicken at the chop of an axe and a splatter of red, though civilization itself holds the handle. And God provides the sawdust where the severed head rolls.
Well, but I...
Not that I mean to be morbid or unfeeling. That's the room up ahead, third door. Yeah, that's the way. All the same, as I was saying, certain people of poetic disposition, after witnessing the grim work of justice done, take on the befuddled appearance of my friend John Furley here. Which is not, of course, to say that... Here's the door. Bring him in. This way, yes. Thank you. But then it may be something else entirely. Some holy vision which left him weak. After all, his way of life, solitary, brooding, and
all. Oh, it's a common occurrence, my lord. Monks half out of their wits coming down from the monastery. Shall we put him on the bench?
Easy with him.
Say, what the devil's going on here?
Ah, Oswald, there you are. It seems heaven's granted us an unexpected guest.
Oh. My God, sweet pain, it's John Furley.
So it is, Ives, our old friend John Furley in the flesh.
I'm sorry, all this trouble.
He's definitely got the look of a man who's being bubbled on the head. Ives, pass the brandy.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. John,
I hardly know how to thank you all.
Now, hush, John. Drink this. Oswald.
Yes.
Go bring us your lovely velvet cloak.
You mean my...
The same. Oh. Come, friend Oswald. But... You've no need of it just now.
No.
The king won't be calling a parade.
Old Trevor. What has happened?
Well, I found him over there by Ravenshold at the foot of the mountain, my lord, baffled and befuddled as the day he was born, pale as my lady the moon.
Thank you for bringing him in here. Have this for your trouble.
Oh, my thanks, sir.
Innkeeper? Yes. Bring our friend supper and wine. Move those old battle legs quickly this once.
Oh, that's how well, my lord. Will there be anything else?
Nothing yet. On your way now.
Very good. Oh, after you, old man.
Oh, no, after you.
No, to the contrary.
Oh, I insist.
But I insist.
Out, you dotards.
damned upstart peasantry.
Yes.
But disorders in the nature of things these days. Guards off fishing in the northeast corner of the universe, and the devil's usurped his throne. Hey, John?
It's no use. He can't hear you.
Faded out, you think?
His eyes are closed.
Gone like September.
Oh, we can't have that. John. Hmm. John, are you all right? Can you hear me, John?
Oh.
Whatever's happened, you're safe enough now. You're with dear old Ipswich friends. Here's Ives. He's a cook now in the service of King Richard.
Yes, it's Ives, John. Can you hear me, lad? And here's Oswald. He's one of the king's Cheshire archers.
Yes, it's Oswald, John. You remember little Oswald?
Oh, Christ. Save me.
John, can you hear me?
Thomas. And Ives. And Oswald.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, how strange. After all these years. Where am I? What the devil?
No. Just lie back, John. Rest yourself.
Oh, yes, forgive me. I don't know.
Have more brandy, old friend.
Where am I? Tell me, what's happened?
You seem to have had some kind of accident, my boy. We only just met quite by chance ourselves, the three of us, Oswald, Ives, and I. Can you imagine our surprise when you came?
An accident? Yes, it's coming back. No, I can't remember.
Oh, never mind. It'll all come clear soon enough. Ah, that'll be our host with the food. Come in!
It's not much, I'm afraid, my lord, this time of night. But man shall not live by bread alone, as our Savior says. The meal's a little short of your heart's expectations. Sweeten each morsel with a Bible verse.
Serfs will like that to King Richard. And he'd have your head, innkeeper.
Oh, no doubt of it, my lord. Thank God he ain't here.
Never mind. Set it down, sir. John, can you sit up?
I'm stronger now, yes.
Set it down, man. Set it down.
The cold chops, criminal. Oh, and that wine. Smell it. They serve better in the Turkish dungeons.
Most true, but our monks renounced all worldly pleasures. Who am I to corrupt my guests? Will that be all, my lord?
All for now, host. Good night.
Good, very good. Don't hesitate to ring. Good night, sir.
His Majesty's rat hounds wouldn't eat such stuff. Oh, well, never mind, John. Here, set to.
Oh, yes, thank you. This is all very odd. The three of you here, wherever here is, it must have been, 10 years ago, at least. The four of us traveled our separate ways. Thomas to Lincoln's Inn to study to be a lawyer.
There's good money in law, John. And splendid opportunity for picking up, you know, a small bit of forfeited land here and there, or a line on some maiden who's not yet apprised she's about to become wealthy.
You're married then, Thomas?
Oh, very happily, yes. But I'm a busy man. I rarely see the girl. I'm not such a cynic as I sound, you know. I have my faults, of course, as don't we all, but it's a useful occupation, the practice of law. I shudder to think what the kingdom might come to without it.
Yes, true. True, I suppose. And you, Ives?
Oh, I'm a cook, Furley, and the finest in England, if I say so myself. somewhat more than a cook.
Somewhat more? You make yourself sound like a part-time poisoner.
Got the best of you, Furley.
Oh, no poisoner, not Ives. Though I'd be willing, could be, if I saw it was a matter of the kingdom's defense, and if the order came down from the proper authorities. You know, there are odd things afoot here in England, I can tell you. Plots and counterplots, country preachers out stirring up the peasants, armies of the barons on move at night. We look to the king for some sign of direction. You know how it is. Oh, maybe you don't, since you've been off all this while in your monastery. No, there's plenty don't love the king. You can take my word for it. Plenty looks back to the days of King Edward when we all felt like King Arthur's Knights of the Round Table. But there's none of that now. Richard's a pacifist. He won't even fight the Irish. Well, he makes knights of them.
Come now, something's to be said for peace.
Oh, well.
In any case, John, I'm no poisoner, not yet. No, I'm more like an inventor in the culinary line. I mean, that's what I meant when I said I'm something more. I can feed a whole army or a mob of starving peasants faster and cheaper than's been done ever before. Well, that is accepting the case of our Savior's loaves and fishes, huh?
You've discovered some secret system, Ives?
Oh, it's no secret. I'd tell the whole world my system. I'm as true a Christian man as John Furley here, though I may not have taken a hair shirt and shaved my head.
Oh, I'm impressed, Ives, and not surprised, all things considered. I remember the time Black Death hit Ipswich. You were 7 at the time, but ready to hunt down old Pestilence and part him from his throat.
Yeah. Well, he eluded me, thank God, and now I'm older, I take pains to elude him. And it's no good cooking for the plague-struck. And what good's a dead cook to next year's crop of the starving, huh?
And you, Oswald.
Oh, Sir Oswald now. Timid little Oswald's grown up to be a Cheshire Archer, God's word.
A Cheshire Archer? You in the king's private guard?
Well, I've turned my cowardice to account, you might say. Shall I tell you what we do? Wherever the king goes with his damned royal trumpeters, we Cheshire archers go marching all around him. And every 50 yards, we shoot an arrow in the air. The whole 700 of us. So the arrows come pouring from the sky like a rain of yellow wood. Nobody comes near enough to threaten King Richard, believe you me. Everywhere we pass, we leave a trail of gleaming feathers. Desolation in the form of dead rabbits.
You know him well, this King Richard?
As I hope to see God. Him and all his quirks and drunken rages and glittering apparitions.
He can be difficult, I'm told.
Oh, difficult he is. Every night, 300 of us sleep beside his bed to protect him from the ghosts of the people he's delivered to the headsman. I ask you, how's a man to put an arrow into a flimmering ghost?
Sure, that's...
Nevertheless, he's got his good points, King. King's like you, Furley.
Oh?
Dark-mooded, full of gloomy ponderings. Likeable in his way. He's a philosopher, poet, and religious as a dying nun.
Sounds ominous in a king.
Same old Furley. It does my heart good to hear you grump again. Remember the way he used to tell us the world's getting colder?
So it is, you know. A century ago, they grew wine grapes in England.
Yes,
true. Oswald's right. It's a curiously pleasurable feeling to be back in the aureole, so to speak, of John Furley's gloom.
John Furley's gloom.
It makes life more important somehow. More significant. What point to the general senselessness of things if nobody troubles to be annoyed by
it? I noticed that, too. Queer that a cook to King Richard himself should be made to feel substantial by a lugubrious, penniless monk.
Substantial? to have a talent for the contemplative life. All this fiddle-faddle we're involved in. Politics, commerce, the jockeys at court. Rumor and counter-rumor. Will the peasants revolt? Will the spite of the barons bring civil war? Has the king gone mad? Mere shadows passing on a wall, as the fellow Chaucer says. I admit it, John Furley, I felt a little shudder of envy when you turned your back on the twitterings of the world for the life of a religious. And yet, here you are. Come back down the mountain. That puzzles me.
And here you are, the three of you. That puzzles me.
Yeah, it's a weird coincidence, no question about it.
A wonderful piece of good luck, that's a fact. Have you really no memory at all of what happened? Perhaps you were run down by a carriage.
Frightened by a kelpie?
I've no idea. It's all like a dream, as if you, all of you...
By George, I'll tell you, I think we should try to reconstruct it.
Reconstruct it?
Exactly. Tell us, Furley, what you do remember leading up to tonight.
Tell us anything, start anywhere, and we'll try to make out what overcame you.
Yes, that might work,
well,
you know.
Let's try it.
Tell us something, just to start with, about your fellow monks. Come. Don't be shy, John. We are your oldest friends. Our desire to know all is only natural.
What do they eat, and what do they do for sex up there?
How do they keep fit? Do they hunt, for example, or hold wrestling matches?
You ask too much. Please, friends. It's not like that at all. Sex and hunting, hardly. No, you'd never understand.
Oh, come. We have all night, and we are in some measure sentient creatures. Make us understand, John. Ives, give a jerk to the bell rope and capture a small one.
Oh, a splendid idea.
So, tell us, John.
Well, it's a quiet place. Plainest food in the world. And as for sex, there's none.
Oh, come on now. Not so much as a whiff of it, eh? A little natural tumbling in the bean lot now and then, eh?
Never, Ives. The renunciation of the world up there is absolute and severe and... And after a while, not even painful.
Yes, come in, sir.
You rang, my lord.
More wine, please, host. Bring a large jug of it.
Yes, the biggest you can carry.
Not much, my lord. Behold, I vanish into air.
That's a big job, too. So, go ahead, John. You mortify the flesh, you were saying. That's natural enough. We can sympathize with that, given the... natural inclination of that life?
Well, it's not that the flesh is inherently evil, not even that desires are unduly distracting. It's rather that...
Go on.
It is a sort of natural inclination, our concern with the moral, our self-denial. How can I explain it? Perhaps this. I did something when I was a boy of, well, I don't know, 15... that I've been ashamed of ever since. A most curious sin.
Tell us, if you like.
Well, let's hear it, by all means.
There was a girl.
Ah-ha!
In Ipswich, you knew her, it may be. Call her Molly for now. I was slightly in love with her. Desired her, that is. I persuaded her to walk with me one night in the lane beyond the Potter's by the brook. You remember the place.
Oh, yes, a famous place.
Infamous.
Easy, John Furley. You can hold my hand because it's dark and there's sheep ruts I could stumble from, but my hand's all you're getting and you know it.
I'm sorry, I didn't intend
to... Oh, hush, I didn't mean it. I like it when you put your arm around me. Now say it, this thing you're so desperate to tell me.
It's hard. I don't know if I should.
Come on, John Furley. First, I've got to see you, Ma. I've got something desperate important to say to you. So poor, simple Molly, she sneaks out her window like a you-know-what. And lo and well away, he can't say it.
I shouldn't tell you. I was wrong. It's stupid.
It's getting stupider, you know.
That's true. Sit, Molly.
What?
Please.
All right. I'll sit. Now, tell.
I'm afraid you'll be angry.
I won't, I promise. Might I be?
I hope not, because I like you very much, and the thing I have to tell you...
Have you any idea how nervous you're making me?
Well, that's true, I must be. And it's really so trivial.
Tell me.
All right. It's this. Your voice is too loud.
That's what you wanted to tell me?
I told you it was stupid. You're beautiful, intelligent. I mean, you're really beautiful, but then you speak, and if you... talk more softly. Try to hold your laughter in a little.
Let's go back.
You see, I've hurt you.
Let's just go back.
And that's all that happened? That's your great sin?
I never saw her after that. I warned you it was a curious kind of sin.
I must say, my friend, I miss the sin in it. A childish error of judgment, if you like. A source of continuing embarrassment, I can see. Perhaps even a shameful loss of opportunity. But sin, ridiculous.
Well, she was lovely and good, and I hurt her needlessly because I had some foolish, idealistic vision of womanhood. For her own good, I told myself. But even if my idea of perfection was right, or my idea of what would increase her happiness, what right had I to intrude on her? I was an arrogant fool fiddling from sheer ego with God's creation. We call gluttony a sin, and lechery, the temptations which lure down men with certain so-called base inclinations. But my inclination led equally to harm. Better if I'd made love to her. Instead, I abstracted her, treated her like some lifeless work of art. Oh, it's a monstrous thing to do.
My dear boy, you blame yourself too much. It was a natural mistake.
No, but that's my point, Thomas. You've asked me how we live up at the monastery, and in answer I tell you, we've renounced the world completely and severely. No harmless clutching, no wrestling matches. But our renunciation is no matter for great pride. For a certain kind of man, such a life is mere nature.
It's a terrible thought, the idea that our noblest moral efforts are mere cosmic mechanics.
Yes, right on.
Rather gives you the chills, you know? Suggests an image, if I may say so, of the whole universe as mere tumblings and fumblings. Mm-hmm. So-called values blindly bumping into each other, if you follow me. Life and death, good and evil, bump, bump. Bump-bump. Horrible!
No, it's hardly that bad, Thomas. We have our choices, all right. What you call so-called values are anything but accidental. It takes enormous effort to discover them, define them, find ways to make them stick. Yet it's true. I'm torn about the way to go about it. I think of that girl. I write her love poems in my sleep, and I think of those values I laid on her like an axe. I wake up in that godly, desolate place and... Listen, I'll tell you how it is at the monastery. We strain every sinew to become perfectly one thing. Pure mind, so to speak, pure vision. The act of life is a twisted web of bad compromises. It has in itself no pure ideals, no absolute purpose beyond physical survival. Except insofar as he's influenced by idealists. King Richard, for instance, does not what he should for the benefit of England, but what he must. Or what he can. Or what he can get away with, given the pressure of the barons crackling with fury and greed. The restless peasants, the merchants all slippery as fat brown snakes. King Richard... What are ideals to him? He's read holy saints' lives like the rest of us. But lofty ideals are beyond his means. They merely check him a little, troubling his dreams, stalking his castle in the shape of unsightly apparitions. The contemplative life, on the other hand, is...
Yes, come.
Have your wine, my lord.
Ah, good.
Innkeeper, you should stay with us and listen.
What?
It would improve you, sir. A man of your years has more sins than the rest of us and should snatch at every straw for the saving of his immortal soul. We're hearing about the life in the monastery. You mentioned, I think, that it's a common occurrence for monks to come down off the mountain in a kind of mad day.
Oh, that girl, my lord, sometimes stark naked. Oh, singing lunatic song.
Well, come sit and hear the reason and be uplifted.
Well, I'd be glad to if I might. I won't deny I'm a curious devil.
Devil indeed.
Well, come on, then sit down.
So I will.
Continue, John.
I'm boring you. I'm sorry.
No. Go on. You've forgotten our purpose.
Exactly. We're trying to reconstruct what happened. You'd come to doubt, you were saying, the contemplative life, the so-called long-range view of good and evil.
It's cold comfort, anyway, for people suffering right now. But I don't mock what we do up there apart from things. Down here, a man strains his spirit to the utmost in battle, and you praise him. What for? because he killed some poor fool. Blew up some beautifully wrought old bridge or some hospital, some church. Now, we on the mountaintop strain to see into the heart of things. Grasp the very essence of evil and good and haul the news back into the world like a dragon's gold. The day will come, I promise you, when people will be amazed that in our day we cut off the prostitute's nipples or cut off workers' hands for refusal to pay taxes. We who merely think and pray have our use, you'll find, if it's only to make the tyrants uneasy.
And you've rejected that life, it seems.
Perhaps. I'm not sure. I keep thinking of the way I behaved toward that girl.
Well, so the monks have no sex, eh? No bibbly dibbly.
None, and no hunting, no wrestling.
No pity.
We live by rules as harsh and steady as the principles governing the turning of the spheres. Rules like the rules of a game, you might say. Uh-huh. Arbitrary, more or less, but absolute. Conventions against which we test our faith and love.
Like a lawyer's precedents or a cook's recipe.
Oh, yes?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. We take your meaning. Or like that curious stiff-legged ostrich strut with a band of Cheshire archers cross parading with the king.
Here, just watch that, watch it.
Oh, yes, we all love our sweet, sweet rules, eh?
They're games, I admit. Finally, just games. Nevertheless, we take them seriously up there. I could tell you, for instance, about the monk's temptation game.
Oh, temptation game? Magnificent. Hey, that's worth a refill.
Temptation game. Scrumptious.
Go ahead, John. The rules?
Well, at least once in his life, every monk leaves the monastery for 40 days and nights in imitation of our Savior. To submit himself to temptation by the devil in the wilderness.
Incredible.
No doubt. Nevertheless, they do it. And ever after that time, the monks talk soberly about the temptations they endured. Their visions. Their subtle successes and failures.
I was frightened, all right. 10,000 of those black creatures galloping toward me. All shaggy as mountain goats and their eyes red as coals. And the smallest one, big as three oxen, God's truth. But I said a quick prayer. And my heart became calm again. And as they were bearing down on me some 20 feet away, rumbling and shaking the mountain like an avalanche, I looked up and I said, "Get you back to hell, you devil creatures! If you were real, one of you'd be sufficient." That instant, they vanished.
Curious experience.
A temptation brilliantly overcome.
Yet, it's odd you had need of the gratification of speaking to the beasts. Was it pride, I wonder?
Possibly, brother. But it would have been more an act of pride to keep silent. Saintly to the point of unwholesome complacency.
It's a hard question. Father Runyon, I'm sure that's a question you've considered. Tell us your opinion.
Oh, I've considered it, yes, of course. I think in the end, speaking up may well have been an act of sheer love. Partly love of life, partly joy in God's love. And thus, not part of the temptation, but a reasonable response to it.
So it felt at the time. But it's hard to know.
It's always the residue of moral uncertainty that gives the temptation its fundamental interest.
Obviously, dear brother. Otherwise, the motivation of the vigil itself might be suspect. Lead us not into temptation, we say.
A difficult saying.
All holy sayings, when carefully considered, prove difficult.
Come, John Furley. They really talk like this, these monks of yours?
Hour after hour.
Oh, my. Oh, my.
No doubt I'm misunderstanding you, John, but it strikes me as, forgive me, but absurd.
So it seemed to me, too, at first. When I first heard word of the temptation game, soon after entering the monastery, I asked the abbot about it. This same Father Runyon I've mentioned. He was old, very old. A huge man, as large as a Russian bear, but gentle. And it seemed to me exceedingly wise. Father, what earthly purpose can this 40-day vigil serve?
Earthly, my son?
Well, heavenly, then.
Well, now, I'll tell you. It's merely, let us say, a kind of testing of the equipment, a sharpening of the tools. Now, a man learns some curious things all alone, with a bellowing wind, a pack of howling wolves, dark, groaning trees. Learns his secret doubts, his greed to stay alive at whatever cost, his anger at the indifference of the universe to his will. He's a devil's man, then, crying in his beard because he suddenly understood that if he happens to die, even the people who loved him best will remember a man he never was. And in due time, they'll barely remember him at all. Tearing his hair because he's realized at last that he feels true loyalty to nobody. Nothing. Merely sucks in life like a pulsing bog, and turning people's smiles of timid, self-regarding hope into flattering mirrors of his own cheap magnificence, his own groping wish. Or he pounds the gravel of the earth with his fists because all he desires beyond potatoes and dead flesh, the planet's sacrifice to his mindless need, has eluded forever his ability to believe. What is virtue but cowardly precaution? What is power but an illusion of escape from gravity? What is love, mighty love, but a projection of one's death here onto riches the world can better spare? So much for wisdom and power and glory, says the monk to himself. The world's all blackness and unsyllabled thunder. Cold stone wolf slopes and the yawp of lean, masterless dogs. Out there in the wilderness, after 40 days, nothing has meaning but the sense a man plants in it. No use to hearken back to the wise opinions of your grandfather. Not out there. Such voices grow faint after 40 days of hunger. Your robin of the green out there, surviving through winter by supping on your own white guts. Whatever darkest filth is in you, the devil puts on that shape and comes.
And people survive it?
Oh, yes, often. The best do. And occasionally the worst.
And what do they learn from it?
Self-abandonment, my son. At times, a sense of humor about life. Sympathy from discovery that the problem's universal. As keep listening to the talk of the brothers, you'll see for yourself.
Amazing, John. Remarkable sport.
And eventually you took part, I take it, in this temptation game?
I did.
Delicious. Tell us about it.
Oh, yes, by all means, John. Oh,
come on. No
stinting.
We want the whole grizzly business.
Oh, yes. You'll be disappointed, I'm afraid.
Oh, we'll be judges of that. Shall I pour more wine?
More wine all round, and God bless you, Holmes.
And you were threatened by phantom beasts, no doubt. Now, poets are always the quickest to be alarmed by phantoms.
Or seductions were attempted by drippingly luscious, fair-haired maidens.
Or your heart was lured by great mountains of treasure. Or perhaps obscene statues done in rare as jade.
Nothing like that.
Nothing like that.
Oh, hush, my lord, let him tell me.
Well, the monks went with me only as far as the door. I took, as the rules of the game prescribed, a small jug of water and one loaf of bread. Those who had experience of the devil's tricks gave me last-minute warnings on what to beware of.
He, or rather they, since fiends are legion, can fool in a curious way with time. Oh, nothing he doesn't do on more ordinary occasions, but disconcerting all the same.
Yes, Father.
Events you'd never dreamed or experienced before, he can make seem familiar, even monstrously repetitive.
At times, the devil fools with your mind in other ways, blurs things important that you might otherwise have used to guard yourself, and he can cause you to see things, needless to say. He can raise up castles or country inns, mighty potentates, old friends. So be wary, Brother John, and all will go well with you.
I will, brother.
One more thing.
Yes.
Whatever tricks he may play on you, you have, remember, one great protection. By the power of our Lord, old Satan is constrained to give evidence that there's something amiss. Some bold hint that the order of heaven has been suspended. Only some miscreant, inclined as the devil is to an assertion of chaos and an arrogant denial of every good and decent impulse he's ever experienced or witnessed, only such a person can be swept off his feet by the philosophy of hell.
But, of course, one must have some sense of what is true.
As all men do, brother. In the words of St. Dunstan, it's planted in our nature, as it is in the nature of a cabbage or a pig.
Yes, it's a difficult saying.
And so I left the place. I traveled alone as I was born to the most desolate reach of the mountain. And there I kept my vigil.
Exactly. And what happened?
Yes, what happened?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Absolutely nothing.
Stranger and stranger.
Oh, you certain you saw or heard nothing at all?
Not a thing. Well, the brothers were disappointed when I told them, needless to say. They were, in fact, all but abusive.
Come, brother, tell the truth. You're toying with us.
It is the truth, brother.
Is it possible you took with you more food than was prescribed?
Well, perhaps he hurt his head.
Tell us more precisely what you experienced, Brother John. Now, how is it possible that nothing whatever occurred?
I can tell you only this. Night after night, there was thunder and lightning and drizzling rain. When 30 days and nights had passed, by count of the scratches I'd made on my jug, I was lightheaded, very nearly too wobbly to walk. I'd look through the rain at some unfamiliar shape. I'd feel for a moment a powerful temptation to turn it into, I don't know, demonic monsters or some ancient hag, the skull of a man, a young woman, a serpent. But I couldn't. Or rather, wouldn't. Let the devil make his own illusions, I remember thinking. And by an exercise of will, I made the unfamiliar shape keep firm. Went up to it and explored it and found it an old stump, the rib cage of an eagle, a white-flowered bush. I felt foolish and worthless. And the urge grew stronger to enliven and magnify my paltry existence by allowing myself to pretend mere flickering dreams were real. But dreams are dreams. I refused to succumb. I went into a cave to avoid the endless rain. Let the devil make it rain in here if he's got the power, I remember thinking. There were bats there, and spiders.
I could have changed the sound of squeaking bats to creatures speaking in ancient languages, but that, too, I refused. My resistance weakened more. A woman seemed to come to me.
John Burley, raise your head and look at me.
No. You're a dream, a rumble of old guilt.
Dream or not, look at me. I loved you, John.
And I loved mere theories.
Oh, you loved me as well as your theories. We were foolish, that's all, both of us. Too proud of our virtue, both of us. You're wrong to feel guilty.
No, go away. You're a dream.
That's not important. What I tell you is the truth.
No, I've loved no one, never.
Then
never.
You should start here, now. What good are theories without love?
But you're not real. I jerked myself awake, and it was true. She'd been a dream. The cave was as before, dark, full of echoes, empty as... Anyway, I hadn't been fooled. I was, as you know, a poet in my youth. What use, I asked myself, is a poet whose heart and mind can trick him? Clear vision, that's every great poet's chief gift, the ability to penetrate artifice and mere fashion, conjure up by the miracle of language what is... Time dragged on. I caught a severe cold. Otherwise, nothing happened.
Oh, you must have done something wrong.
It's a kind of mockery of all we've struggled for. Well,
perhaps another time.
No, my sons. It seems to me you're quite mistaken. He saw nothing, you think? He saw the temptation to lie, play mere games.
Brother John's been successful, then?
Most certainly, for the moment. Oh, there's always the possibility of some devil's trick. Temptation from some quarter where it's least expected. But for now, no doubt of it.
Yes. That seems right.
So, John, you were successful. Wonderful.
But then, how come he's here?
Yeah, that's true. Perhaps we've missed something.
John?
Is it possible?
Go on.
Is it possible the temptation's not over yet?
Ridiculous. Oh. Here you are, safe among old friends.
Oh, is he? You can say for sure we're not dreams.
That's an interesting question,
John.
I say nonsense. He's a realist. He'd know if we were dreams.
John, wake up. Give me your hand.
Where are you?
Wake up, John. Quickly.
There's something more, John. Remember, concentrate.
John.
Oh.
Concentrate.
I never told you, I think, my own temptation.
Never? No, that's true. Do tell it to us, Father.
Yes. Perhaps I will. I jerked myself awake. Bemused, dazed by hunger, unable to find my way back up the mountain. I had stumbled by pure chance on an old bearded peasant.
Dark as the pit of hell it is, brother. No moon, no stars. Strange, most unnatural. But never mind now. Here, lean on me. That's the way there now. There's a castle up ahead. We'll get help for you there. You have no doubt of it.
Sure enough, there was a curious light far in the distance, and we made our way toward it.
Porter! Open up! Hello in there!
Time passed. No one came. When we pushed at the huge old castle gate, we found it was unlocked. Your
there's a sliver of the moon out now. And by its growing light, we saw an empty courtyard. We went in. There was nearly a soul in sight. It was like the kingdom of the dead. And then, little by little, it seemed to me I heard sounds around me. I gazed in astonishment at the grisly old peasant who'd brought me to the place, and before my very eyes he faded away in the darkness like dispersing fog. The sounds of life around me grew clearer now, and as much as the peasant had faded away, living beings, I thought, began to emerge out of the moonlit air. There were knights in queer, old-fashioned armor, and courtly ladies in the dress of some bygone century. And they were all quite solid now, as solid as you are, brothers.
Excuse me, sir.
And I hailed them, went up to them, one after another.
What am I, might I ask?
But they ignored me, every one of them. And it came to me at last that perhaps I myself was invisible.
Incredible.
I moved in astonishment toward the castle's interior, passed by the guards, they never blinked an eye, and traveled up a long stone stairway till I came to a high, wide, grandly furnished room. In the center of the room, two kings were deeply engrossed in a game of chess, and I drew near the chessboard to watch the play. And after a time, it somehow came to me that the king on my left was none other than King Arthur of old. And the king on my right... But that was a mystery. I could only describe him to myself as the other king.
Your Majesty!
And now, suddenly, while the two kings were playing, a royal messenger came running into the room and hurried to King Arthur.
The knights of the round table are drunkenly shooting the other king's falcons. And great is the havoc, for many are now dead.
King Arthur glanced up at the other king and said, "What is your will, sire?"
"Play the game."
King Arthur's messenger departed then, but soon he was returned, more agitated than before.
"Your Majesty, your knights in their madness have driven further. At this very moment, they are tearing the other king's falcons to bits, and the feathers they scatter to blow in the wind far and wide."
Again, King Arthur said, "What is your will, sire?"
"Play the game."
And so the messenger departed. Not long after, the space of two moves later, a second messenger came rushing into the hall, and this one ran straight to the other king's side.
"Your Majesty, strange news! The falcons, King Arthur's knights destroyed and tore apart utterly, are miraculously gathering to their former state, both feathers and flesh, and in a great flock are moving toward King Arthur's knights."
It was the other king who said,
"What is your will, sire?"
King Arthur, I could see, was exceedingly distressed. But at last he said, "Play the game." The messenger departed, bowing as he left. But he soon returned and went, as before, to the other king's side.
"Your Majesty, the falcons are attacking King Arthur's knights, tearing their eyes out and slashing at their throats. And if their fury goes unchecked, all King Arthur's goodly knights will soon be slaughtered."
The other king smiled and looked darkly at Arthur.
"What is your will, sire?"
King Arthur said nothing. He was quiet as a statue. And then, abruptly, I realized that I, by some mystery, was in fact King Arthur. I'd mysteriously dozed off. My beloved knights were dying. And in terror and fury, I seized the chess pieces and ground them to dust in my fists. The same instant, the other king was transformed to a creature with dark red eyes that had hair in them.
God preserve me!
strange temptation, Father Runyon. I'm not sure I understand it.
A strange temptation, John.
Yes, strange. Father Runyon had been fooled for a moment, you see, but he saved himself, breaking free of the game, abandoning the monstrous rules. And then, in the final instant, he drew back. Terror over love, mere paltry terror. He clung to his life as a monk. His harsh, arbitrary discipline stayed there, high on his mountain.
The moral being, if I may ask.
Well, I left the monastery the following morning to return to the active life, as they say, to the world where there are thieves and murderers to be brought to the bench and monarchs to protect from some maniac's ambush and the hungry to be fed.
And so you've abandoned your talent for peering inward, for taking, as they say, the long-range views.
I left, came down off the mountain, yes?
You've actually turned your back on that life.
Mm. Well, it's just as well, no doubt. There's a great deal needs doing in this stupid world.
It's always tempting, of course. The notion of going away somewhere, getting in touch again with so-called reality.
Yeah, that's tempting.
Tempting.
Well, life's no game.
Temptation Game by John Gardner. Russ Reed was heard as John Furley. Ralph Bell played Thomas and the first monk. Ray Owens, Oswald and the second monk. Denny Spence, Ives and the third monk. Paul Ballantyne, the innkeeper and Father Runyon. James Lawless, the peasant. And John McKinley, the girl. Original music for The Temptation Game was composed by Herb Pilhofer. The play was directed by Carl Schmidt, with technical realization by Tom Vagley for Earplay, the Radio Drama Production Center for Public Broadcasting.
Earplay is made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.